Today's guest on Physicians Beyond the Bedside is a physician colleague of mine, Dr. Matt Denenberg. Matt and I worked together from 2014 through 2018. Matt is a dual board-certified physician in both emergency medicine and pediatrics. Matt has held many physician leadership roles in healthcare organizations during his career and has served on many boards and been involved in many other leadership activities. Recently, he transitioned into an exciting and larger role as the chair and chief of pediatrics at Corewell Health, Beaumont Children's Hospital. Corewell Health is the name of the organization formed by the merger of Spectrum Health, which is now Corewell West, and Beaumont Health, which is now Corewell East. Sit back and enjoy this episode. I'm happy to bring it to you. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Physicians Beyond the Bedside. I'm your host, Dr. Norm Chapin. Physicians Beyond the Bedside is a podcast that will help you find a non-clinical role and take your career in new, rewarding, and sometimes unanticipated directions. I am very happy that you have joined my podcast audience and community to learn about opportunities beyond the bedside. Welcome to Physicians Beyond the Bedside. It's really great having you on the show.
Great. Thanks for having me, Norman. This is a pleasure for me.
Well, it's a pleasure for me as well. It's been a long time since we've had a chance to connect, and I've been looking forward to this.
Yeah, no, I think it's been at least 6 or 8 months, and I've been following your, you know, path the last year, and I'm sure you've been paying attention to what I'm doing, so I'm really looking forward to this.
Yeah, well, thanks again. So maybe you could start out by just telling us a little bit about what your current role is and where you are professionally.
Yeah, sure. So I am currently the chief and chair of pediatrics and children's health at Corewell Health East at Beaumont Children's. And that's kind of a mouthful because I really, you know, at this point in my career, I actually have four roles. I'm the chief of pediatrics for the Children's Hospital, and I'm the chair of pediatrics for the Oakland University William Beaumont Medical School for pediatrics. And so those are two roles. And then I have an executive role within the medical group. So I'm responsible for the medical group practice side of things. And then there's a fourth role that I am responsible now for, the new pediatric service line that covers Corewell Health East, so the entire east side of the state for Corewell Health for pediatrics. And so it's a new role that was created. It's really four jobs in one, and I've been at it since April, just still trying to figure out how to manage four bosses and four roles. But it's been a lot of fun, and it's exciting, and there's a lot of children in the east side of the state that we're responsible for taking care of. And so, you know, that's kind of where I'm at now. And then I'm still practicing about a day a week clinically, doing shifts in the pediatric emergency department. You know, by training, I'm an emergency physician that specializes in pediatrics. So I still get a chance to see patients and take care of patients and families at the bedside.
So tell me a little bit about, if you could break down each of those four roles, and it sounds like a huge scope. How do you divide up your time, not only from the one day a week that you're doing clinically as an ED physician, a peds ED physician, but how do you manage the complexity of those four very high level, large roles?
I think the way to put it is, there are four roles in a relatively large health system here on the east side of southeast side of Michigan or Southeast Michigan. I divide them up and I try and devote time to each of them. But I will say all four of them really overlap. And, you know, I will say if I'm in a meeting or talking to a provider or working with a student, if you ask them to say, which hat is Dr. Denenberg wearing today? It's really hard to tell. And the reason why is, the physician executive for the medical group piece is the part that's responsible for the employment and the compensation models and for our employed pediatric specialists, which is about most of our specialists are employed. So I have about 80 or 90 physicians that work for me and as in the employer, as the medical group. And so that's that executive piece. The chief piece of my job, I'm really responsible for the medical staff portion, the portion of the job that deals with credentials and privileging for pediatricians within the children's hospital. The service line role, as we've expanded and created a service line, is to look at strategy and how we do pediatrics across all 11 hospitals across the Beaumont system. So our hospitals in all geographies and how we're going to manage pediatrics in each of those facilities, whether it's newborn care, emergency department, the hospital service in some of our hospitals, all the way to our trauma center here in Royal Oak. And then the last piece is the part about the medical school. And that's the part, quite frankly, that's newest to me that I'm really enjoying is I actually get to interact with medical students. So like the 4 years of medical students, I'm actually a mentor for the incoming class for about 18 students. And I get to actually be the chair of a department of pediatrics at a university, which is really new for me, but it's been a lot of fun to learn how to do that. So I'm responsible for the students, but I'm also responsible for the promotions and for my providers that actually have roles and ranks at the medical school.
So what type of infrastructure do you have underneath you that helps you delegate some of the work and offload some of the tasks that you just couldn't manage on your own?
Well, Norm, I'm an ER doc, so I just do it all myself. No, I'm kidding.
I get that.
What I would say is I have a really strong team underneath me. So each of my specialty has a chief, has a physician leader, and a manager or a director with them for that specialty group. And of course, our programs in some areas aren't as big as large children's hospitals. And so, you know, that manager or that director might have four or five specialty areas. So I have physician leaders and managers, directors within the clinic or specialty space. I have a director of operations full-time who's an MBA level person who helps me manage contracts and the logistics of running the business of pediatrics. I have a nurse dyad partner. So our associate CNO happens to also be a pediatric nurse who's actually my full-time dyad for working on the care pathway work, building out our service line in the operations of pediatrics. And then at the university, I have associate deans that help me learn how to do the university work of promotions. And of course, I have a really, really good administrative assistant that helps, you know, keep me in check, helps me keep track of my schedule, helps me get things done. And then we've recently created CarePath with a service line. I do have a project manager that helps me sort of coordinate some of the projects we're doing across the entire system. But of course, that person also works with three other, you know, chiefs and chairs. And so it's a split position. So lots of infrastructure, kind of fractured infrastructure, but it works for now. As we're growing, I suspect there'll be more infrastructure underneath that. And in fact, we'll probably have a vice president of the service line at some point, which will be an operations person that will be my dyad for the, you know, the whole operation. It's about $100 million operation right now. So we'll need some more structure underneath it eventually.
Gotcha. So what did you do in your career to kind of prepare for this size of a role or this type of a role? You mentioned that as far as academic medicine and being the chair of an academic department wasn't really part of your background. Maybe starting with that, what did you do when you found out that this was going to be part of your role to really prepare for that transition?
So for the chair piece in particular for the university, I've always had an affiliation and or an appointment with medical school throughout my role. So whether it was Wayne State or Michigan State. So I've always had either, you know, academic positions or roles within a university. So whether it's teaching residents, teaching students, you know, getting a master's degree. And so I've always had an understanding of how promotions and how the academic side of things work. And so when I took on this role, I've been leaning heavily on the dean, who's been very helpful to me. And of course, the associate deans are helping me with the paperwork and the process. But, you know, like anything else, it's the relationships, right? When I first got there, I spent a lot of time up at the school. I'm working with the students. I actually offered to be a mentor of 18 students. So I've, you know, jumped right in to make sure I had a presence there. And I think that's helped. The business part, the logistics, the bureaucracy, that's something that I'm like, that's in everything we do. So that part is coming with experience, but it's really getting up there and showing that you're engaged and interested in being involved in the university that's been helpful.
So what was your motivation initially, going back to kind of the beginning of your career? You mentioned you were a PZD physician. How did you initially get interested in non-clinical roles in medicine? What was the motivation or the impetus for you to move into non-clinical roles?
So if you go back far enough, right? So when I finished residency, I did, you know, 6 years of residency. I did two residencies. I did emergency medicine and pediatrics. And I was destined out of residency to just go practice medicine. In fact, my very first job out of residency was in Alaska. I got a phone call from a person who was living in Fairbanks, Alaska, and said, "Hey, we see you're interested in the West. You want to come to Alaska and interview?" And I said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "We'll fly you out on Friday. You'll come for the weekend and you'll fly home." So I said, what the heck? I was a resident. I didn't have any money. So I flew out to Fairbanks, Alaska. It was 40 below when I got off the plane. And I spent a weekend in Fairbanks in the snow and I took the job. So I spent a year in Alaska and I figured I'm just going to be a clinical ER doc in the Great White North for the rest of my life. And then, of course, you know, Cheryl, my wife now, and at the time, my fiance, she's like, "I'm not going to 40 below and it's too dark." And so, and I also knew that I wanted to do more with teaching and training, and because I had come from academic centers, right? So when I came back to Michigan from leaving Alaska, I got a call from a recruiter in Grand Rapids and said, do you want to come out here and look at a job at Butterworth Hospital? And again, why would I want to go to Grand Rapids? So I went out to Grand Rapids, talked to the recruiter, and they were getting ready to start expanding pediatrics, right? At the time, it was a large general hospital with some pediatrics, a couple of rooms with Disney stickers, and it really was just getting started. And that was the beginning of it. I took a job. There was two of us that were pediatric ER docs, the first ones in. And at the time, the leader of the emergency group, Ralph Rogers, asked me, do you want to help us just design some protocols? Do you want to just help us design some best practices for pediatrics? And I said, sure, but I still want to practice a lot of medicine. And Norm, you know how it goes. First, I was doing protocols and procedures, and then I was designing the schedule, and then they wanted a section created. And then before you know it, I was the section lead for pediatric emergency medicine. And then I was the medical director. And then someone had this great idea of building a children's hospital and said, you know, we got to design an ED from the ground up. And so that's how, right? I just kind of kept saying yes to helping to make things better for children in the emergency department. And it just snowballed from there, right? I didn't really do anything intentional until I started getting these positions and roles and opportunities to make things better for providers and staff and kids. And then it just one thing led to another. I just kept moving up in the ladder. And in fact, you'll appreciate this, and maybe I shouldn't say this in a recording, but my first four or five leadership or executive jobs happened without any sort of interviewing, because I had this sort of that traditional path of who wants to volunteer. And then I just kept doing things to expand that. And so you probably hear that all the time from physicians.
Yeah, I think that's a very common, your story resonates, I think, with what a lot of us have experienced, in that we didn't really design where our career was going to go. We just kept saying yes, and we kept being tapped for more and more things, and we wanted to help.
Yeah, I actually have had less experienced physicians come to me and ask me, hey, how can I get into administration? Because someday I'm not going to want to be in the trenches. And I said, be careful, because being in the trenches sometimes is easier than being in some of these roles. I said, it's not easy. And we agreed to do these things over the years, but this is not easy work. So I will say that's one of the reasons why I continue to practice clinically, is I love to get back to the bedside. I'm not saying it's easier or harder. It's different, and it's rewarding in a different way.
So as you moved up into these leadership roles, and I know a little bit of the story, obviously not as well as you do, because when I came into Grand Rapids, Helen DeVos was already in full swing. But as you moved into these leadership roles, what were some of the most surprising things or some of the most difficult issues that you found you had to overcome as you transitioned from the bedside to a non-clinical position?
Yeah, you know, and again, at risk of this being listened to widely by people that could get me in trouble, I'm just teasing. I think one of the biggest things I would say is I'm an ER physician. I know you are too, Norm, so you get this. I'm used to, in clinical practice and in my training, I go in a room, something's going on, I engage the team to do something quickly, make a decision, and that patient moves on to the next level of care, whether it's the ICU or home or whatever, right? And even in life-threatening situations, right? We make a decision, we give them medications, we deliver a shock, we do all these things, and it just, it's boom, 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 it's quick, right? The biggest barrier, and I still struggle with this, I'll admit it, is the process and the intentionality of the work that has to happen for things to get done at an administrative level and for the operations of a hospital. And I'm not belittling bureaucracy or politics. I think it's important. And in fact, it's something that we all have to learn how to manage and navigate and work with. And I think that's the biggest barrier or challenge for me, is how to get through that and still get things done in an effective manner. And I've gotten pretty good at it, but I still stumble. There's still times where I just want to get something done, or I think something needs to be done and I need to step back and realize there's a process in place, especially as organizations get bigger and bigger, right? I started out in a little small hospital in Alaska, and now I'm in the largest health system in the state of Michigan. So it's just a very interesting, 25-year transition I've had.
So what have been, as you realize that, what are some of the things that you did to kind of change from that ER fix it now mentality to a leadership style that allows you to engage stakeholders differently and really allows you to achieve the goals that you want to achieve?
I think it's really, really important to listen to your team. I think it's really, really important to develop relationships, whether it's internal or external, with patients, with team members. And I think it's extremely important never to jeopardize those relationships. So, you know, you're going to need people to help you make those decisions quickly. You're going to need people to help you develop strategies over the long period. So I think it's learning how to develop relationships with people, even with people that you don't necessarily always get along with. You still have to have relationships that are productive and respectful. And I think that's the thing I've learned the most, is really to learn how to communicate better with people that you work with and people that you may work with in the future and people you work with in the past, right? Don't, you know, it sounds trite, but don't burn any bridges. I think that's really, really important. And so it really is, no matter what you do and what business you're in, it's the relationships that get things done.
Mm-hmm. I guess maybe for lack of a better term, do you have a particular leadership style that you have developed, or have you picked up certain leadership attributes that you feel have really worked well for you, or others that didn't work so well?
Yeah, I would say the one thing, and I'm probably not being going out on a limb here, the one thing that people would use to describe me as a leader, and it's both a positive and, you know, a weakness, is, you know, people have teased me or joked around that I'm the fixer, right? If something needs to be done or needs to be fixed, or there's an issue, you know, if you take it to Matt, he'll figure out how to get it done, right? And so I think that I've just, you know, maybe it's that ER mentality. I've just kind of learned over time that there's a solution to every problem, and you just have to figure out how to get there, whether it's getting people in a room together to work together, whether it's knowing who to contact, whether it's knowing where to go in a hospital or in an administration to get something done. But that's also one of the things that's been a weakness, is sometimes you assume that you're going to be able to get things done and you go too fast, and then you look back on it and be like, you know, I missed four steps. And so, but I think my ability or desire to get things done and make things easier for people is a leadership style that I think people appreciate most of the time, but not always, right? There are times where people are like, just stop, right? We have to take some time to do this.
So you mentioned right now that you're still working clinically one day a week. There's a lot of physicians in non-clinical roles who continue to work clinically, and there's a lot of physicians in non-clinical roles who feel that they can't continue to work clinically. So you mentioned that it was one of your passions to kind of stay at the bedside in a certain role. Have your thoughts on that changed since you've assumed this larger role? And where do you see that going for you in your career a year down the road, 2 years down the road?
So back to the fact that I'm an ER physician, I think I'm a little biased in this answer, because one of the reasons why I was able to find the time to get into these leadership roles, right, to take on these responsibilities, to go get a master's or to get two master's degrees, actually, to go do all this stuff, was when you're an ER physician, you can work shifts. And so I was able to carve out time to do these things when I wasn't clinically active and make a good enough living as an ER physician that I was able to have that time to do those things. And so it's always just been sort of inbred in my leadership style that I'm going to be clinically active. And I think you'll see that there's a lot of ER physicians that become leaders in medicine for that reason. And it's also helpful that when I was helping, you know, work with our EHR design, I was using the EHR. When I was helping work on develop our privileging, I was using those privileges. When I was helping develop a pathway for behavior work, you know, or for, you know, for safety culture, peer review, I was subject to the same peer review as everybody else. And so, you know, that adage that there's some credibility that's earned as a physician leader who's still clinically active, it's true. That said, these roles and one I'm in now is such a big role. There are times when I come home and my wife's like, what are you doing? It's 2 a.m. You're just getting home and you got to be at a meeting in the morning. So I think there are times where I understand why people no longer can do all of it. And that's especially true for providers that are in specialties where, you know, you're a surgeon and you just can't keep up the skill, or you have to have a panel of patients. So I think I've been lucky because I'm an ER doc and I can continue to do that and I enjoy it. And I know this is a long answer. What I would hate to see is a physician who really loves practicing medicine or really loves taking care of patients to stop doing that because of these jobs. But I understand why some people have to stop because of the job. And I think there's a nuance there that I hope I'm describing well enough, right? I can keep up my passion for taking care of patients because the kind of doc that I am, an ER doc, allows me to. But if I ever got to the point where I felt like I couldn't safely take care of patients, I'd stop. In fact, I haven't done an adult shift in 3 years because I can't keep up with adult and peds. And I love adult medicine. I have given up that part of my practice. Does that make sense, Norm? I know that's kind of a long answer, but I think it's important to stay clinically active if you enjoy it. don't stay clinically active for the sake of it, though.
Right. No, I think it makes a lot of sense. And I think there are physicians who feel just as strongly about not being able to safely practice medicine as they work. And I think it is somewhat specialty specific, although I've talked to some ER physicians who have struggled with maintaining a level of competence that they're comfortable with when they feel like they can only do one shift every 2 weeks or one shift a month, because medicine is a rapidly changing field. And sometimes it's not so much the knowledge as it is the ability to multitask. Or if you're a physician leader in a small hospital, I've talked to physicians who feel like they can never take off the administrative hat when they're working a clinical shift, and people come to them to solve problems administratively while they're trying to focus clinically. And it becomes very challenging for some.
I'll admit, I don't do midnight shifts anymore. Mm-hmm. And I would not go practice in small town Alaska as the only doc in the hospital again, right? So I'm in a pediatric ER who's an academic center with fellows and another attending. In fact, I don't think they'll schedule me on a solo shift right now.
I have a special offer for you today. I have created a list of the top 10 leadership skills physicians need to develop to be maximally effective in leadership roles. The skills I included on the list have been studied and have been found to increase the effectiveness of leaders in any organization. You definitely need to cultivate and develop these skills to increase your effectiveness when assuming a leadership role. Physicians, of course, are leaders at the bedside in clinical or in non-clinical settings. These skills will benefit you whether you are at the bedside or beyond. Please visit my website, physiciansbeyondthebedside.com/top10leadership skills, for your copy of this resource today. I will also include a link to this resource in my show notes. You can simply click on that to receive your free copy. So one of the other things I'm interested in is, you mentioned this before, a lot of physicians get credibility from how well they practice medicine clinically. And that's oftentimes how we're tapped for leadership roles. You practiced in the same organization for many, many years where people were very, very familiar with you as a physician, as a clinician. And now you've moved into an organization where that knowledge is not embedded in the organization. How did that feel?
So this goes back to what we were just talking about, because actually I negotiated as part of my agreement, right? There was some talk about these roles not being clinically active, that I wanted to be clinically active. I think there's an assumption that's made, especially in larger academic centers, that if you're coming in as a chief or a chair, that you must have clinical expertise. And if you've been practicing something for 20 years, I think it's assumed. And it's mine to prove them wrong. And fortunately, I can only prove them wrong 3 or 4 days a month, right? I have, you know, a fellow and another attending to help protect me. But I do think that there is an assumption that someone who's been practicing pediatric emergency medicine for 25 years is competent, especially with some of the things I've done, right? Over the years, I've been involved in research and academics. But I'll tell you, I had to go back and redo ATLS. I'm going to have to redo NR, like I have to keep up. So I think there was a little bit of discomfort on my part of my first couple of shifts. And even now, right, I haven't intubated a baby by myself in a couple of years, right? So there is probably some sense from people that, you know, Matt's only working shifts with another attending. I think you get a little leeway when you take on these roles. And I think people are surprised that I'm actually working clinically. Not that I'm incompetent, but because I've got such a big role.
No, I think it's a real challenge to see enough, to see some of the low frequency, really high risk situations is challenging when you cut back on your clinical time. And I experienced that as I moved into leadership roles within an emergency department. And then certainly as I assumed leadership roles at the hospital level, it became even more and more challenging.
I'll tell you one experience I did have, and this was a couple of years ago when I took on my first really big system role. I actually had to have a very difficult conversation with a leader who had to sit me down and say, you know, Matt, you know, you've been leading in this department as a clinician for a long, long time, like essentially help build the department. But when you're working a clinical shift, we really need you not to be an administrator, and we need you not to be on your phone, and we need you to be. And ever since that conversation, I sign out and turn off my phone for the most part when I'm working a clinical shift and I am teaching residents and students and working with APPs. And I took to heart, you know, that was a blind spot of mine, right? And to your point earlier, I had to have a leader come to me, and I know it was difficult for them. It was probably hard for them to do that because, you know, quite frankly, I probably had recruited them or hired them or was responsible. And they were like, you know, Matt, you know, this is how you're being perceived. And I think that's the other thing as a leader, you've got to be able to take that kind of conversation and be humble enough to understand that I'm going to continue to make those mistakes. I know I am. And I hope that I have people working with me that are willing to, confront me about those things.
So I want to take a little bit of an opportunity to pivot and talk about a real issue that's come into view, I think, during the pandemic. And that's sort of healthcare burnout, physician burnout, nursing burnout. You and I have talked a little bit about this before. But in your career, have you gotten to the point where you realized that you were experiencing burnout because of all of the responsibilities or tasks that you had taken on?
So this is an interesting conversation because there's a group of us that are at the point of our career where I'm not at retirement point, right? But I'm also been out long enough that I remember, you know, before we had duty hours, you know, when I was, you know, I remember as a resident being on the hospital doing things that with the attending at home and the chief resident at home, and they were like, you saw us do this once, right? So, you know, 48 hour work days, right? I remember all that. And so to me, burnout means something a little different, right? Working long hours, being tired, being exhausted, to me, I don't struggle with that part of burnout. Where I get a little bit, where people might say, I sense a little bit of burnout and maybe it's frustration is, we talked about this earlier, there are so many things that are affecting our teams. You know, not enough staff, not enough supplies, too many patients. I get a little bit frustrated because, you know, we talked about this earlier in my career. I told you people would come to me and I'd be able to fix stuff. It's getting harder and harder to fix stuff. So I think that's what's getting harder and harder for me. It's kind of like, you know, when I was younger, I could, you know, train and run a marathon pretty easily. Now it's lucky if I can get out and run 4 miles and be like, I'm not doing this anymore. So I think to me, the sense of not being able to do things as easily or navigate as complex a system as I used to be, and I don't like the word burnout, but that's kind of the burnout that I'm feeling a little bit, is it's harder for me to help fix things for my team. And I think that's probably what I'm sensing, but I'm not ready to give up, right? I'm going to keep going.
I think that the understanding of burnout has come a lot closer to what you were referencing, and that is that physicians can work long hours, they can work hard and take care of patients. But when that moral injury component comes in where they don't have the right resources, they don't have the right staff. And in talking with physicians and nurses during the pandemic, even right from the beginning when there were issues with protective equipment, you know, personal protective equipment and respirators and enough gowns to really protect the staff, that led a lot of physicians who were in leadership roles to feel more moral stress than the fact that they were asking themselves and others to work long hours. It was really that they weren't able to provide a safe environment for the clinicians to work in. And I think that caused a lot of issues with physicians in leadership roles. But the studies are pretty amazing. When you look at the data with the number of nurses that have left the profession, the number of physicians, I think the last article I read a few weeks ago was 177,000 physicians who've stopped practicing medicine since the pandemic started.
Yeah, I worked a couple of shifts about a month ago during the height of this RSV surge, right? When we had 50 in the waiting room, you know, 20 kids waiting for beds, ICUs full, no ICU in the state of Michigan was taking patients. And they just kept bringing in sick kids. And the hard part, you know, I told this to my team, I was okay with, I'm an ER doc, right? I trained in inner city in Detroit. Like, I'll be okay if you keep bringing me patients and I have to keep intubating patients and give them oxygen and run around, and I can do that for 48 hours. What I can't do is have people come to me and say, we don't have an RT to cover these 7 patients that need treatments and 4 of them are decompensating because they're not getting there. That's hard, because then you look and like, then you kind of throw your hands up and be like, now there's nothing I can do. I don't even have the albedo in my pocket to go give it to them. I just have to stand here and hope someone shows up. That's the first time in a long time I felt what might be described as burnout, is I can't do anything to make this better right now. And I'm the chief of the department. That's what you're getting at, right? Not being able to do what needs to be done.
So given what we've discussed about burnout, lack of resources, lack of staffing, are there programs or projects at Corwell Beaumont Children's that you're have gotten underway or that are getting underway to offset this, number one, the mass exodus of healthcare workers that we're seeing and the challenges that we have with supplies and other resources as the pandemic kind of drags on?
That's a really sort of tough and loaded question. You know, an article just came out today, and whether it was, I don't know whether it, which healthcare magazine, talking about the five, you know, sort of four or five things that are facing all health systems, right? So staffing, you know, line infections, you know, the things that we're all facing, right? The ability, you know, lack of resources, burnout. And I think we're all trying to do those things that are short, medium, and long-term, right? Long-term, you know, we're all starting to do things like trying to support nursing schools, trying to support RT schools, trying to get people to draw people back in. You know, the short-term fixes are things like more pay, right? More bonuses, retention bonuses. Those things only go so far. I think until we start doing things to allow our teams to understand the importance of the work they're doing and to be as engaged as we were in our sort of generation healthcare, we're going to continue to really struggle with burnout and people leaving the field. And we had actually had a conversation about this today. We have to find a way to start engaging the public. You know, if people don't start realizing how overburdened and overtaxed our health systems are, especially our not-for-profit health systems, if we don't start letting them realize that we're a 4 or 3 or -4% margin business, and we're not Amazon, we're not Google, we're not Apple, I'm not sure there's an easy way out of this, Norm. I'm not sure there are a lot of strategies aside from long-term strategies of getting people more engaged in healthcare.
I guess as I talk to and coach and mentor physicians who are looking to move into leadership roles, and you alluded to this a little bit earlier, there's almost a sense that being away from the bedside is in some ways easier than remaining at the bedside, especially in the past 3 years. I've heard that increasingly.
If you're not practicing clinically, you've removed yourself from that part of seeing what's going on. And it's one thing to sit in a meeting and have someone raise their hand and say, we need more nurses, we need more RTs. You know, there's 45 patients in the ED, the waiting rooms. But unless you're actually experiencing that, it's really hard to empathize with your team. And so you're no less likely to try and find a solution, but you don't necessarily appreciate the urgency because at the end of the day, you didn't live through that. And I think that's the other reason for me staying clinically active is so I can understand some of the decisions that I'm making or not making. So maybe I do have to make some decisions to increase nursing or RT at the expense of building this really cool cardiac program. And I think that unless you've got a sick kid in front of you that can't get Ventolin in the moment, you may not appreciate how important that is. So I think it is a little harder to be away from the bedside for some physicians, especially those that spend a career taking care of patients.
So as you talk to physicians and you coach medical students, residents, and physicians who have less experience in leadership roles, what are the one or two pieces of advice that you find yourself repeating the most often or that you find yourself getting feedback that they were the most valuable pieces of advice? What really seems to resonate with the people that you're coaching and mentoring?
And this is getting harder and harder to do the busier you get, but make sure you're spending time with and understanding what your frontline teams not only are going through, but what they feel or know or recommend is part of the solution, right? They know best. They are at the front line. They are at the sharp end. Whatever term you want to use to describe this, you really need to understand and work with them. And I'm careful not to say, listen to them, because I'm not the greatest listener in the world. So listening is not enough. You have to really engage them and understand and let them be part of the solution. I think that's the number one thing is, you know, there's some truth to some of these stories you hear about, you know, Alcoa and all these companies that turn safety around, right? You got to engage the folks that are in the trenches, for lack of a better term. So that's one thing. And the other is, and I'm a big fan of mentors, pay attention to the folks that came before you. And your mentor doesn't always have to be someone that's 20 years older than you. Sometimes your mentor is a colleague that you trained with, but you have to make sure that you're not trying to do this on your own. So make sure that when you're in leadership roles, that you have partners in this work. And it might be somebody that you trained with who lives 1,000 miles away, or it might be someone who's no longer in healthcare, or it might be someone who's not even in healthcare. Just make sure that you are leaning on mentors and people that helped you get to where you are, because there's a reason why they helped you get where you are.
Thanks for that advice. So I always like to ask my interviewees also if there are any particular resources, books, websites, anything that you found particularly helpful as you moved into your leadership roles that you would recommend to my listeners.
I have to be careful again. You know, I've never worried so much about getting in trouble. I've always been a little skeptical or a little suspicious of all of the books out there that we all read and we're all asked to read to improve our business acumen or our leadership style. And the reason I say that is you can always tell when someone's been to a conference or just read a book because they start talking about that author's book. And what I would say is a lot of these books, Norm, there's some common sense in a lot of these books and they have similar themes. And so I'm going somewhere with this, I promise. I would say networking and working with your peers and reading these books together is important. And I'm a big fan of biographies. So leaders that have come before us, people like, you know, Jacques Cousteau, people that have been, you know, adventurers or explorers, you know, to try and understand how they've done what they've done. You know, Bill Gates is another example. So trying to understand how people, leaders led, not so much their advice for, you know, buzzwords, right? So I would say, you know, trying to understand, you know, pick leaders, people that you aspire to be like and read about them. And I think, you know, even, you know, Alexander Hamilton, right? You know, starting to understand him and how he got things done. That said, there are some books, good to great. There are some things out there that, you know, we all have that list that I think everybody should read. But I really do think learning about people that have come before us, great leaders, I think is more important. And read about leaders that failed. Try, what did they do wrong?
Mm-hmm. That is a very valuable source of knowledge. I know you and I have talked about this before, but learning from your own mistakes is a great way to develop new skills. But if you learn from other people's mistakes, it's also an excellent way to avoid some of those traps with a little less pain than learning from your own.
If somebody were to ask me when I get close to retirement to write a book about my mistakes, I think they'd have to bring back the encyclopedia 26 volume, right?
Yeah, I think we all have that sense, stepping on landmines and doing that throughout your career. So,
you know, it's interesting you say that. One of the things that young leaders to realize is help the other leaders, help your peers, help those above you not to step on landmines. You know, and again, it's not about kissing, you know what, it's about helping your leadership team do better for everybody. And I think part of it is we have to watch each other's back. You know, that's where I'm getting with this is I have to be able to call you, Norm, and say, you know, Norm, I noticed something that you might have a blind spot, right? Let me, because I expect you to do that for me too.
No, that's great advice. Well, before we wrap up, is there any other information that you thought we were going to talk about on the show, on the podcast that you really feel you'd like to share with my audience?
I thought you were going to ask me when the big merger in Michigan is going to be, but you know, quite frankly, you know, we learn about it in the news every other day. So no, you know, I think one thing that I thought you might ask me is, you know, again, I have a sort of traditional physician of my era or my generation path to leadership, right? Continuously just kind of doing things to make things better for wherever I was working. And I always get asked, Matt, do I need my MBA? Do I need my Master of Health Administration? And I always tell people, no, but, right? So, you know, I have three masters, right? So I did those things along the way, not to be able to get these roles, but you asked me before what I read. It was to supplement what I was learning to be better at what I did and to network, right? So I, you know, my master's, my safety work was so that I could understand better how to improve what we're doing. So I think as long as those degrees or additional training, I know you have additional training as well. As long as those are supplementing what you're trying to accomplish as a leader and not as a ticket to become a leader, I think that, yes, I think those things are important. And unfortunately, it's getting harder and harder for physicians to get leadership roles without that on their resume. So I, with caution, say to people, it's not necessary. I think it's important, but I think it's unfortunately becoming more necessary. And I don't know, what are your thoughts around that? Because you talk to a lot more physicians about this than I do.
No, I think you're right. I think compared to 20 years ago, when I started on my journey into leadership roles, the issue of whether you had an MBA or not, or a master's in healthcare administration, or a master's in public health was really irrelevant. I mean, most CEOs that would interview for a CMO job or system job, they didn't really ask you many things about that. In fact, I remember 20 years ago when I was thinking of going to my MBA, I went to my CEO and said, hey, will you pay for half of my MBA? And he's like, why would you go to get an MBA? I mean, you have a chief operating officer at the hospital, you have a chief executive officer, you have the chief financial officer. You can learn all you need to know about the business of healthcare from them. And it took me quite a while to convince him that there was going to bring a value back to the organization if they paid for this degree. But I really did feel like, for me personally, that there were things that I wanted to learn for myself that would help me in that role. And I eventually succeeded in convincing him to help supplement that. But I think you're right. Over the last 15 or 20 years, if you're trying to get a chief medical informatics officer job and you don't have a master's degree in informatics, or if you're trying to move into healthcare leadership and you don't have some type of an advanced degree, it's a little bit of a harder sell than it used to be.
And I'll add just quickly, I'm always a little skeptical of somebody who's trying to or has gotten into physician leadership and never done anything clinical. And I'm not suggesting there isn't a path for that, because there are examples of people that have done a really good job of that. But how can you be a physician leader if you were never really a physician? And I'm not saying that somebody who never practices clinical, there's not lots of reasons for doing that. But if you don't understand that dynamic between a nurse and a physician and a doctor and a nurse and a physician, and the simple things of rounding and calls at 3 a.m. and, you know, a dying baby. I mean, it's just very hard for me to understand how you can be a physician. You can be a business leader without, you could use medical school as a means of getting, you know, an education and learning to think, but don't sell yourself as a physician leader. And so I struggle a little bit because we're seeing more of that.
Yeah, I think the timing of getting the degree, and I think you said it very well, is if you're using it to supplement your education and to drive home some leadership lessons that you feel like you need as you advance. But I do think MD, PhD programs where people go straight into research and eventually may work their way back into kind of a physician leadership role, or someone who does a dual MBA, MD, or MPH, MD, I think it's a little more challenging to really understand and to serve as a physician leader, because you don't really understand the clinical, what it's like, as you said, to know what it's like at 2 o'clock in the morning when you're struggling with a downtime and your ED's crazy busy. That's a very emotional experience. It's something that you never forget. And whether you eventually stop practicing clinically or not, I can remember situations that were that stressful, like they happened yesterday. And if you've never experienced them, I think it's very difficult to empathize with the physicians who are currently going through a crisis like we are now, or like we have been over the last 2 years.
I can remember experiences during my residency that still drive how I do things now.
Yes. Yeah, me too. It doesn't seem like it's been 30 years since I experienced those situations.
It hasn't, Norm. You're dreaming.
Well, Matt, this has been great. I really appreciate you taking the time out from your busy schedule to come on the podcast. And I hope that we can continue to stay in touch and maybe do another podcast and kind of follow your career through the podcast.
That'd be great. I appreciate it. This has been a lot of fun for me, Norm. It's good to see you.
Nice to see you as well. Take care.
Yeah. See ya.
Thank you for listening to today's show with Dr. Matt Denenberg. We covered a variety of topics in a very short interview. As Matt touched on, healthcare organizations are facing many severe challenges today in order to meet the needs of the communities they serve. Healthcare organizations are extremely complex, and the leadership skills necessary to cope with that complexity as a physician leader is growing. This is reflected in executive leaders' focus on the track record and additional training a physician has obtained when they are hiring for a physician executive role in their organization. The value of mentors, coaches, and sponsors within the organizations can't be overemphasized. Matt's emphasis on strategic learning and skill development based on a person's individual goals and objectives is very relevant to this situation as well. If you are considering a leadership position within a healthcare organization or are considering a move to a larger, more complex role, his comments will have been extremely valuable to you. The two resources, A Guide to Effective Decision Making and the Top 10 Leadership Skills and Attributes You Can Sharpen Today, remain available on my website also. These resources are also extremely valuable for physician leaders as they consider additional leadership opportunities. A reminder that you can download these free resources by visiting www.physiciansbeyondthebedside.com/effective-decisions and www.physiciansbeyondthebedside.com/top-10-leadership-skills. I will also include Matt's LinkedIn information if you would like to reach out and contact him directly. Links to additional resources will also be included in the show notes. If you have any comments or questions, please feel free to add them in the comment section on the website, www.physiciansbeyondthebedside.com. I love hearing from you, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast by clicking the subscribe button in the show notes and add Physicians Beyond the Bedside to your podcast library. I would also appreciate it if you could leave a review of my podcast, share my podcast with your friends and colleagues that would benefit or have an interest in the content. Please take good care of yourselves, and as always, good luck moving beyond the bedside. I would also like to invite you to join my private Facebook page, Physicians Beyond the Bedside. Go to Facebook and search Physicians Beyond the Bedside and ask for permission to join the group.